So as I said, we can go rather slowly. I want to revise. This is because we are having a philosophical exposition of the theme of life divine. If it was some other exposition, we could have very brief statement. The brief statement could be that we are here on the earth to manifest the divine consciousness in the physical life. And let us work on it. And the question will be only to find out the means by which we can do it. Then our attention will be on the process by which we can do it. But since this statement that we are here on the earth for the manifestation of divine consciousness in physical life is a philosophical statement, we have to consider how do you know that we are here on the earth for the manifestation of divine consciousness in physical life? And how are we sure that this is so? Not only how do we know, but how are we sure that this is so? Now some people might say, we are sure because we have been told by our teachers that this is so. This kind of an argument may satisfy many people. But then that is not a philosophical answer. Even if it may satisfy one or two or many, there will be still many people in the world who would not be satisfied. And you will have to converse with them in due course of time. Therefore, even if you dispense with philosophical discussion on the subject, sooner or later you will have to be engaged in a philosophical discussion with others who will demand a philosophical answer. As Sri Aurobindo says, intellectual approach can be dispensed with by some or by many. But it cannot be dispensed with if we are to deal with this problem on the scale of humanity. If it is only a few individuals, you can dispense with this question. But if it's a question of dealing with humanity, and if this message is to be given to humanity and not to X, Y, Z, and if we are also interested in answering this question to humanity, then intellectual approach is indispensable. It is for this reason that we have undertaken this task. For ourselves, to have a philosophical assurance of this proposition. And in due course, to empower ourselves to be able to answer this question to many others in humanity who will ask this question. It is for this reason that we are studying the life divine. Because the life divine has been written in answer to this important issue. To give to ourselves a philosophical assurance that our life here is meant for manifestation of divine consciousness in full manifestation in the direct physical consciousness. Sri Aurobindo says that the aim of this book is to give to ourselves a rational assurance that divine life on the earth is indispensable, it is inevitable, and that each one of us has to participate in it, and has to participate in it with deliberate cooperation, with our willing free cooperation, and the sooner we do it, the better it is for everyone. We have already made a journey in this process. We have read the first four chapters. And before we come to the fifth chapter, I think we need to recapitulate. Because fifth chapter is one of the most difficult chapters in the book. It has a recapitulation of the first four chapters. It introduces new elements. And these new elements are introduced on the supposition that the reader is well equipped to receive these new elements which are now being introduced. So let us first of all recapitulate what you have done so far. As we all know, Sri Aurobindo begins by a historical argument. You can see that this word human aspiration has three significances. One is that all philosophical thinking rests upon aspiration. This connection between philosophical thinking and aspiration is extremely important. Why Sri Aurobindo begins with human aspiration is because this is a philosophical book. And if human aspiration and philosophical thinking are inevitably connected with each other, it is best to start with that particular connection. It is by human aspiration that all philosophical thinking can be justified. Why do we think philosophically at all? Because of aspiration. Why? Because philosophical thinking is a search for meaning, the search for essential significance. And significance is related to aspiration. It is because of aspiration that we are looking for significance. If there was no aspiration, there will be no looking for significance and therefore no philosophical thinking at all. Therefore, to start with human aspiration is the inevitable starting point of philosophical work. Many books on philosophy do not start with it. They start with something else. But you cannot say that these other beginnings which are made in philosophical works have got their inevitability. The inevitable connection with aspiration and significance being present, and as significance being connected with philosophical thinking, therefore a philosophical book can best be started with a statement of aspiration. Now, aspiration is to be determined. What is it that man aspires for? Now, one could have asked the question, what does the universe aspire for? And that is not the question that Sri Aurobindo asks. It could have been, what is the whole world aspiring for? Sri Aurobindo marks out only one, that actually speaking, the aspiration is fundamentally to be found among human beings. Even if it is present everywhere in the world, it is in human being it becomes more manifest. And it is human being, whether he likes it or not, is making effort to satisfy his aspiration. The central point of the world is this. Therefore, Sri Aurobindo speaks of the human aspiration. Now, that human aspiration, he defines in four terms. Man aspires for God, light, freedom, immortality. Being a philosophical verb, we have to ask, is it really true? Is it inevitable fact that man is aspiring? Or is it an assumption? In philosophical thinking, all assumptions are to be questioned. Even if you start with a supposition, in due course of time, that supposition will have to be questioned and to be answered. Now, Sri Aurobindo, because he starts with human aspiration, he makes it sure that the very first proposition is supportable by human history. So he starts by stating that the earliest preoccupation of man in his awakened thought also seems to be the highest. You look at the whole history of mankind, he admits that this aspiration has not been constant. There are times when this aspiration ceases to be very operative. There are periods of skepticism, agnosticism, vital seeking, and many other things. But Sri Aurobindo says that even after those periods, short or long, human being returns back with his aspiration. Therefore, there is something so fundamental in this aspiration that our whole history of mankind can be regarded as one big cry, as if man is constantly looking for God, light, freedom, immortality. Or prominently asking it, not constantly, prominently asking for it. How do you know mankind right from the beginning has been doing it? So Sri Aurobindo says, look at the earliest records of man's aspiration. The Veda is the earliest record of endeavor. And in these records, we do find this aspiration writ large. How do you say it is also likely to be? Because Sri Aurobindo says that even now we are passing through a period of skepticism, materialism, denial of this aspiration. But at the end of this journey, we find that mankind is satiated with whatever he has been doing at present, but not satisfied, and therefore trying to return to this primal longing. Now, those who have read the history of mankind will be able to justify this statement. Those who have not read the history of mankind, we are not fit to study this book, because it is the background that is necessary to be able to appreciate this statement. Because people who have not studied history of mankind thoroughly well, he may not be impressed by this statement at all. A person, for example, who has not read Kant, may not feel so much struck by these four words which Sri Aurobindo brought out. Because Kant is not a very old thinker, He is one of the new thinkers, modern thinkers. And he is one of the most prominent thinkers of our times. And whether one agrees with Kant or not, all philosophers of today have got to take cognizance of this philosopher. And this philosopher happens to say that in the ultimate analysis, there are three postulates which you cannot question. Or even if you question, you are bound to come back to them. And he says, God, freedom, immortality. This is his conclusion. We need not go into his whole philosophy, how he has come to this conclusion. But at least from historical point of view, it is a fact that this great philosopher of the 19th century came to the conclusion after studying the whole gamut of knowledge. Actually, he's supposed to have given a tremendous book called Critic of Pure Reason and Critic of Practical Reason. And having examined reason in all its aspects, he has come to the conclusion that there are three important aspirations of man which are unquestionable: God, freedom, immortality. And they are not only postulate, but he says they are inescapable. Ultimately, you've got to believe in God. You've got to believe in freedom. You've got to believe in immortality. And philosophically, you are bound to do it. Mind you, he is the one philosopher who has given criticisms of the proofs of existence of God. In our most recent times, if there is one philosopher who has criticized the proofs of existence of God, it is Kant. But having criticized those proofs, he has given his own proof. So he could not escape it, and he has concluded that we are obliged to accept the existence of God, accept the existence of freedom of man, and we are obliged to accept that man must be immortal. These three statements, he said, are inescapable. Now, it so happens that these are the three prominent words also in the Veda. It so happens. It's not something contrived. If you read the Veda, you find these three words constantly appearing: God, light, freedom, immortality, all the time. Now, this is not a historical accident. Kant had not come to this conclusion after reading the Veda and all that. And Veda had not read Kant to make this proposition. It so happens, objectively speaking, if you look at the history of the world, you find that the Vedic rishis spoke of God, light, freedom, immortality, whatever be his reasons. Rishis did not inquire into pure reason and all that and came to this conclusion. Modern time, we are inquiring into reason critically and all that. Even then, our conclusion has been the same. It's a very palpable fact. So Sri Aurobindo says that whether we look at the past, remote past, or we read the latest one, the aspiration of man is found to be described so vividly in a short formula: God, light, freedom, immortality. Now, this is the aspiration of man. Now, Sri Aurobindo says, this aspiration also happens to be its last. Happens to be its last. But Sri Aurobindo says, it promises to be its last. That word promise is very important. It doesn't say it is the last. Why? Because it's a philosophical statement. Unless you have proved that it must be the last, it is the last,
It's only a kind of promise. Why is it that it is continuously going on in the whole history of mankind? Therefore, it promises to be last. Of course, the philosopher himself has full reason to believe it is the last. But when he is expounding, he has not yet proved. Therefore, the only good word that can be used for that purpose is that it promises to be last. As I had said, the very first paragraph has got two important statements. One statement which is qualified by the word seems, and one statement which is qualified by the word is. And in philosophical terms, these two words are very important. Seems is only a probability, and is a definitive conclusion. So I had said that Sri Aurobindo, in the very first paragraph, he uses both the statements. He says that this aspiration seems to be the last, promises to be the last. But he also says, is also the highest that thought can envisage. Now there is a distinction between the two. You can say a conclusion to be probable if you have a historical argument. A historical argument cannot end in inevitability, because historically nothing is inevitable. The conclusion that you derive from an historical account about the future can be only promising, at the most probable. Therefore, as long as the historical argument is there, he uses the word seems, promises. But when he comes to the question of asking whether this aspiration is definitively in consonance with the highest reasoning, this connection, Sri Aurobindo says, is an inevitable connection in thought. I had said this first statement, where the word is used, is a part of ontological argument, that God is the highest that thought can envisage. In ontological argument does not say that God seems to be the highest. Ontological argument says God is the highest. Therefore, where Sri Aurobindo is stating the ontological argument, he uses the word is. Where he is using historical argument, use the word seems. The upshot of the first paragraph is only this, that human aspiration can best be defined in terms of God, life, rhythm, immortality. It is the highest that thought can envisage. Therefore, as far as the intellectual thought is concerned, it is inescapable. As far as historical process is concerned, it is likely that this is going to be the last one. Having said it, perhaps no question may remain in the mind of a student. He can simply say, I am now convinced that I must now work for aspiration, the fulfillment of the aspiration. But that may not be true of every student. Every reader, he might say, your conclusion is that this is going to happen, likely going to happen, likely to be fulfilled. How can you say it is bound to be? This bound to be fulfilled is a further proposition that is being proposed in the whole book. The whole book is written only to show rationally that this aspiration is bound to be fulfilled. So there is still a big distance between the proposition which is made that this is likely to continue, this aspiration is likely to continue,
and it is bound to be fulfilled. Therefore, a lot of argumentation is necessary. You might say the whole book is only an answer to this question. How can you show, how can you demonstrate rationally that this is bound to happen? If we want to prove this statement, we have to determine the steps of proving this statement. The proposition is that there is a consciousness which is called divine consciousness. Divine is to be realized. When we say aspiration for God, means that I am aspiring for God to be realized. So there must be an assertion that God exists. I have to prove that God exists. If God is to be manifested in bodily life, then body must exist. In other words, matter must exist. I have to prove second statement, matter exists. If spirit is to manifest in matter, then I have to further prove that matter is capable of manifesting spirit. Not only matter should exist, but should be capable. Material nature should be such. In other words, I have to prove that there is no fundamental conflict between spirit and matter. If by very nature spirit is one thing and matter is quite different, if they are in constant conflict with each other, then the proposition is unworkable. So I have to prove that matter must be capable. It must not be in conflict with spirit. Thirdly, I have also to show that matter and life, I want to manifest God in physical life. Therefore, matter and life also must be somehow reconcilable with each other. I have to manifest God not only in life but in physical life. Therefore, there should be no conflict between God and life, life and matter. Further, if there is any distance between God and life and matter, and yet I believe that God will be in matter, then if there's a distance, then that distance should be coverable. If it's not coverable, then my proposition cannot be true. Now, in history of thought, all these propositions have been denied. And that is my big problem. It is said, by some, God does not exist. Some say matter does not exist. Some say that life and matter are bound to be conflicting with each other. For some time they can come together, but not forever, because everyone dies ultimately, so matter is more powerful than life. Therefore, the wedding of life and matter is not possible. Divorce is the only answer ultimately. According to some, God exists, matter exists, but they are so different, so far away from each other, that this distance can't be covered.
Therefore, the whole idea that God can manifest in matter and material life is impossible. And there are many other intermediate denials of various kinds. So unless I meet each one of these denials, I cannot be said to have proved my thesis. Merely by saying that human aspiration has been constant, merely on that ground I cannot say it must happen. Merely my wish will not prove it must happen. And there are many wishes in the world which don't work in the world. So merely wish is not an argument. Even if I say that my thought cannot envisage higher than this, even if I am certain about it, argument could be that there are many things about which thought is very certain, but in life it doesn't work. Therefore, merely to say in thought it is inevitable, it doesn't follow it is bound to happen in material life. Now, all these arguments I must meet squarely. Now, Sri Aurobindo, in the very first chapter, deals with all these questions rapidly and securely in the very first chapter. And there are mainly three arguments. One is that there is a complete contradiction between what is actual and what is aspired for. Aspiration for God, life, freedom and immortality is an aspiration, is an ideal. But actuality has nothing of God in it, nothing of light in it, nothing of immortality here. And what is obtained will always remain. So you can dream, but what is going to happen in the world is only what is here. This is an argument which is put forward. So Sri Aurobindo raises a metaphysical argument. What is a metaphysical argument? A metaphysical argument is the argument which seeks a significance, meaning. So Sri Aurobindo says, if there is a contradiction between the actual and the ideal, you must ask the question, why is there this contradiction? Merely saying there's a contradiction is not enough. Metaphysically, you have to answer the question, why? Why is it at all that in spite of the fact that actual is only this much, why man goes mad and looks after for these things? What is the significance of it? Therefore, Sri Aurobindo says that if we look deliberately, this deliberate reason is the metaphysical reason. Reason is that which is an attempt to ask if there is any reason behind it. After all, what is rationality? Rationality is to look for reason. So you must ask the question, what is the reason of this discrepancy between the actual and the ideal? Even if I am mad in aspiring for God, I have to explain how that madness happens in this world. I have got to explain why, what is the significance of this contradiction? And you have to answer this question metaphysically. No metaphysical thinker can avoid this question. If he is a real philosopher, he has got to answer this question. As I have said, metaphysical thinking by its very nature is a search for the significance. If you don't ask significance, then there is no metaphysical thinking at all. Close the door. You say, I'm not going to discuss this question philosophically at all. You can say that. And stop the debate. It is only because you are asking me the question, I want a rational answer to the question. Then I have a right to tell you that if you are looking for reason, then you must ask the question, why is there this contradiction? Therefore now debate starts. Unless I answer this question philosophically, I have not answered the question. So I have called this argument essentially metaphysical argument. This statement that if you look for the deliberate reason, that word deliberate reason is a metaphysical reason, philosophical reason. So Sri Aurobindo says we have to ask why this contradiction exists at all. Now Sri Aurobindo answers. Now this answer is given on the basis of certain facts. Since I am explaining the structure of the argument, let me say about this word facts. In a philosophical argument, there must be, to start with, data, facts. If there are no facts, there is no argument. Philosophy is an argument based on certain facts, and while correlating the facts, you have problems, and therefore an argument starts. If there are no facts at all, philosophical argument has no place. There are no facts, no argument about it. Now, philosophical argument, however, is a systematic observation of facts. It is not at random. I see a stone here, I see a river here, I see 5-6 people around me. These are also facts. But a philosophical argument observes facts in a very systematic manner. Sometimes I give the example of one of the stories of Sherlock Holmes. Sherlock Holmes says that an officer comes to his room and he has in his briefcase a certain document. He is one of the earliest persons to come in the office. And his coming is noted by the peon, such and such time he has come. And he was the earliest to come in the office. He opens his briefcase and he reads the document. He reads half, and then he has a call of nature, he goes to the bathroom in the same room. He doesn't leave the room. He comes back and finds the document no more exists on the table. Now this is a fact. Now this fact is of such a nature that automatically the question arises, how, why, and who? What has happened? Now this kind of questioning is a natural questioning in which facts are presented in a systematic manner. Sherlock Holmes, when he was told about this fact, ultimately comes to the conclusion that the thief had already come to the room maybe overnight, and he had concealed himself in an almira and kept himself standing, knowing very well the document is bound to come next day with the officer. He will bring it. He's so secret, he won't leave it anywhere else at all. He's bound to read in the office. He's bound to be in the office. He's bound to be in the briefcase. For a short while, he's bound to go out. Or let us say, probably will go out. He's prepared to stay there for the whole day in the, it's such an important document for him. As soon as he goes into the bathroom, it takes only a short time. The man comes out of this almira, comes out, takes away the document, and jumps out of his window and goes away. This is the conclusion that he drew out of this event. And then ultimately he is able to find out, the whole story goes on. But relevant for us is that when an argument is to be prepared, it should be prepared on the basis of certain facts which are to be systematically presented. Now Sri Aurobindo brings forward certain facts before us. And he says, the fact is that all over the world, all problems exist, and they all exist because of the contradiction between actual and real, actual and ideal. He said, not only this problem which we are discussing, but all problems, any problem that you look into the world is a problem. If you analyze any problem, there is only two points. There is an actual and there is an ideal. And the two are in collision with each other. So, now these facts Sri Aurobindo brings forward. Now these facts that Sri Aurobindo brings forward are in the history of philosophy important facts which have never been brought into the philosophical world for argument. But they are very important. He draws attention of the whole mankind. There are certain facts which you must examine. That if you analyze all the problems, you always find basically all the problems are problems of harmony. The question of actual and ideal. Not only that, but there is a constant effort in arriving at harmony. This is also a fact. He points out that simply because a contradiction exists, people don't leave the problem at that. There is a constant effort to overcome a problem. This is also a fact. He says, to leave a problem unresolved is true, is all right for a pragmatic man who doesn't bother, who is interested in finding out a good job and remaining where he is. He doesn't bother whether the sun is running away or not. All problems, he doesn't bother. He said, as long as I can live and have my body and soul together, I have no problem. Purely pragmatic man may not inquire into any problem. But every human being, as soon as he begins to feel a problem, he tries to resolve it. Now Sri Aurobindo gives forward two important facts of a very large data where there is an acute conflict. There is a conflict between matter and life. Matter and life seem to be quite opposed to each other. And yet, if you look at the world, you'll find that all that is living necessarily exists only in matter. All that is living. Not that all that is matter is living, but all that is living is necessarily in matter. Although matter and life are quite opposed to each other. So how has it happened? That is because matter and life have tried to resolve this problem, this conflict. Not human being, but nature itself has tried to resolve this problem and succeeded in injecting life into matter. This has happened. This is a fact, undeniable fact. Similarly, there is a conflict between life and mind. Life is a wild dashing into the world, not tolerant of any kind of pause, waiting, thinking, considering, weighing, finally deciding, then jumping into action. There is a conflict between the movement of life and the movement of mind. And yet it has so happened that all mind, if it has to live on this earth, has got to be in the living form. Where there is no life, mind cannot subsist in this world. Life can subsist without the mind, but mind cannot subsist in this world. So there has been injection of the mind successfully in the life. This has happened. If so, what is impossible about God being manifest in mind? Why should not God be injected into mind? If all the injections have taken place, what is wrong if I make a statement that God also can be injected into material life and mental life? So my conclusion is that if these things have happened already, it's quite likely, and if I look at the logical order of things, that if there is rationality in the world, if there is logicality in the world, then there should be no impossibility. Nobody can argue it will never happen. This is the argument Sri Aurobindo gives to answer this question. If somebody says, how do you prove that God will be injected into what we are now? Now Sri Aurobindo goes further and brings another fact. That fact is of course a kind of an explanation given of the present day of the very problem that we have just now seen, life being injected into matter and mind being injected into life. Now the present fact is that people believe, they have come to the conclusion scientifically, that life has evolved in matter and mind has evolved in life. Then Sri Aurobindo says, if life has evolved in matter, it could be only because life must be already involved in matter. Now, why this argument? Once again, we come back to metaphysical question. Anything that happens, you can answer it has happened. And this answer is all right for anybody who is not rational. A rational seeker ask the question, why it should happen. If a child is told now it is raining, child says, why is it raining? Say, look at the cloud. When there is a cloud, rain comes. then the child becomes quiet because he has an answer why it has happened. This is the law of reason. You might say, if you say that, well, I don't want to be rational at all, then it's another matter. Then have no philosophy. But if you are a philosopher and if you are asking this question, you must ask, why is it that life evolves in matter? And Sri Aurobindo says that no solution of this problem can come about unless you go back to the first principle of explanation. Effect must be present in the cause. This is the fundamental principle of rational thought. Karya Karan, that is Sat Karya Vada, Sankhya. The effect must be in the cause. So Sri Aurobindo says that life evolving out of matter rationally cannot be explained except on the ground which Vedanta has laid down, that effect must be present in the cause. Now, if so, life has evolved in matter, therefore life must be in matter, mind has evolved out of life, therefore mind must be in life. And how can you say that mind has nothing else than mind? Can it be said is the end of the matter? Sri Aurobindo says no. Why? Because there is an analogy between life and mind on one hand, and mind and something higher than the mind. This analogy can be compared. Between life and mind, there have been degrees of development. There are various forms, lower forms of animals and higher forms of animals. And ultimately, the highest form of animal man has come out. So wherever there are degrees of development, you can say it can reach the climax of it. It has happened. Now, similarly, are there degrees of consciousness in human beings? Are there lower human beings in thought power, middle power of thought, higher powers of thought, highest powers of thought, and even going beyond thought? Has it happened? Answer is yes. If so, the highest powers of thought must be present in mind. Therefore, if this has happened inevitably, whatever is in the cause has come out in the effect, this is bound to effect also. Therefore, what you call light, freedom, immortality is nothing but a formula of supermind. So, because supermind seems to be contained in the mind, and sometimes it has manifested from time to time in some human beings, there is nothing impossible if it fully manifests. Now we must remember that this is called analogical argument. An analogical argument is never conclusive, but highly probable. Very highly probable. It can give you a very good ground for affirmation of a very high degree of probability. And unless the contrary is shown, that probability can also result into inevitability. Unless the contrary is shown. This is the argument. Analogical argument has its advantage. If you can show an analogy between 2-3 levels, and therefore you can see it will happen also here, conclusion is probable. But if you cannot disprove then the conclusion that you have arrived at is much more probable, almost inevitable. At least you can't say it cannot happen. You remember the argument was, because actual and ideal are in contradiction of each other, ideal can never happen. That was the argument. Therefore, that argument doesn't stand now. This is the conclusion of the first chapter, which only says that God, light, freedom, immortality, from the point of human thought, is inescapable. From the point of view of the method of nature in which actual and ideal are always in conflict, it shows that the ideal is always possible to manifest. And if evolution is a fact, which is also a fact, and if there is nothing against it, this is most likely to happen. This is the conclusion of the first chapter. Sri Aurobindo says, therefore, we need not fear to aspire. He does not say that we must follow, now completely I have proved the whole case. If this is so, he says, if there are northern lights, that is to say, if supermind is flickered somewhere, then you can be sure that there is a sun somewhere. And because of the sun, this northern lights are flickering now in the northern skies. We can be sure supermind exists somewhere, as a result of which the human mind is sometimes flickering with supramental lights. And given these arguments, you need not fear to aspire. This is the conclusion of the first chapter. Sri Aurobindo says, while going out of this chapter, he puts two important statements. If you see this paragraph, the last but one, if you have last but one, the last five lines, we cannot then bid her pose at a given stage of her evolution, nor have we the right to condemn with the religionists as perverse and presumptuous, or with the rationalist as a disease or hallucination, any intention she may evince or effort she may make to go beyond. Now these two words are very important. These are the two main groups of people who are going to oppose your proposition. The religionists and the rationalists. And we must understand this argument, because later on this argument is expounded more thoroughly. So since we are going beyond the first chapter, it is better to understand this argument in a larger canvas, so that if you come across this argument later on, we are not surprised. It is very important that Sri Aurobindo is writing rapidly and writing rapidly at a supreme height of thought, in which vistas of thought are already summarized and captured, and sometimes some statements are made which may seem to be statement without argument. Now, there are many statements which are really not arguments. Why? Because they are statements of data. Wherever there are statements of data, there are no arguments, because they are data. But there are some statements which seem to be without argument, and there you must pause and ask, have I missed something so that I don't see it as an argument? And this is a very difficult task. Very often you'll find Sri Aurobindo making a statement. But if you have not kept track of the ground that he has covered already, you will only see as a statement. And you'll say, but this is not an argument. Now, many people who read the life even cursorily, they complain that Sri Aurobindo does not argue. Now, I have examined this criticism quite often. When Mother said life divine is intellectually perfect, I have verified that it is intellectually perfect. There is not a single statement, even is and seems, I have shown you. He is so careful that where he cannot say is, he uses the word seems. Where he has not shown to be inevitable, he has said it is promising. But where it is inevitable, he has written without any mincing of the words, it is inevitable. Where, for example, Sri Aurobindo says, if you take a deliberate view of things, there is no excuse about it. He doesn't ask for any pardon for this argument. If you are a metaphysician, you must raise this question. If you don't, you are not a metaphysician. This is the method of metaphysics. Therefore, if he raises this question, you have to understand why he raises this question. Now, similarly, therefore, when you read the Life Divine, you will sometimes come across statements which you will say simply, they are not data and yet statements. But kindly pause and try to see before and after and see whether what he says is argumentatively already established. And at least I have found that always when it seems to be a mere statement, in Life Divine, there are large number of facts which are data and there are no arguments. Because they are data. But wherever there are not a data, it's a real argument, it may seem to be a statement, but it's a statement because it's already proved. And it is proved sometimes because we are not intellectually equipped ourselves. For example, as I said, if you are not equipped with ontological argument, then the very first statement may seem to be a statement and not an argument. When you say that this aspiration is also the highest that thought can envisage, it's only a statement. It's only one who knows that there is an ontological argument that he will find it is an argument. It's not a statement. It's not a datum. It's an argument. Therefore, to understand Life Divine, we must be ourselves intellectually very well equipped. And all canons of intellectuality are thoroughly satisfied in this great work. Now, this statement I am bringing it to your notice, this two statements, because I want to draw your attention, because later on he will refer to these arguments. But we must see that he has already dealt with these arguments. And later on, if he makes a statement and if you have forgotten it, it is your fault, not the writer's fault. So I am now bringing to your notice these two arguments, that there are only two basic arguments, even after all this is said, two arguments still remain to be dealt with. The argument of the religionist and the argument of the rationalist. And he already summarizes in one or two lines, phrases, what is the essence of the argument of the religionist and what is the essence of the argument of the rationalist. Now let me expound. If you tell a religionist that on this earth a supermind, a superman will walk and will establish harmony in the world because of his walking, as he walks, they'll be spreading around him all harmony. Where Sri Krishna appears, there will be a Raslila automatically. But it will happen on the earth, not in Vrindavan only, not only in Vaikuntha only, but here on this earth this will happen. This is what Sri Aurobindo says. Now religionist says, this can happen in heaven. To think that this world is already perfect. That this world will be changed, there will be something new happening. Now this statement is very important. Religionist says, this world was made by God in 6 days. Seventh day, of course, was a holy day. But in 6 days, this world was made. And having made it, God said, wonderful, it was wonderfully done. This world is wonderfully done. Now you say, it's not wonderfully done. Something more has to happen in this world. What will be his remark against you? You are perverse. You are perverse. You are proposing that something will happen which even God had not thought of making. It must be perverse. Or you are presumptuous. You think something more you can do which God will not do. You are presumptuous. This will be his two words which will be used against you. That either you are presumptuous or perverse. Therefore your argument will be thrown away. Rationalist says, there is nothing higher than the intellect. Yesterday we were reading a statement of Bertrand Russell, where Russell says, we refuse to believe that there is anything higher than the intellect. Refuse to believe. I mean, this is a very statement. This is the rationalist standpoint. There is nothing higher than the intellect, and nothing can be higher than the intellect. We say, we do not accept where God-heaven intuitions can come in human mind and can work. And intellectually, therefore, if you examine the world is nothing but matter. You are talking of supermind coming on the earth and walking here on the earth. It's all ephemeral, supraphysical. If you say, I'm very respectful to you, but I can be sure it is a hallucination of yours. All supraphysical things, if at all you think about them, they are hallucinations. So Sri Aurobindo says that either you are a diseased person to think of it, or you are having hallucination. Or your hallucination is because of your diseased mind. These two arguments will come to you all the time throughout. Whenever you say anything, these are the two arguments which will come up. And Sri Aurobindo has said, read the whole sentence. We cannot then bid her, that is to say, bid nature pose at a given stage of her evolution, nor have we the right to condemn, nor have we the right. The words are very well chosen. He doesn't say this is bound to happen, but you have no right. arguments that you have given have given you the right to think about it. You have no right to condemn with a religionist as perverse and presumptuous, or with a rationalist as a disease or hallucination. This right you have no right now. Having given these arguments, you have no right to condemn the proposition of the supramental manifestation of the earth as perverse or presumptuous, or as a hallucination or as a disease. This argument is already now stopped this much. It doesn't mean that these arguments have been now thwarted altogether. Therefore, these arguments have still to be dealt with. And these are the two arguments that Sri Aurobindo devotes to in the next two chapters. The argument of the religionist. Religionist has a big band. One argument that I gave you was only one group of religion. The one group of religion, the Christian world, we said God had made the world in 7 days' time. But there are many other religions who have different views. According to Jainism, the world consists only of two principles. Jiva, which is conscious, and Jada, matter, which is unconscious. Only two principles. It is true that at present they are joined together. How they have been joined together, we do not know. Nobody can say. But they are fighting with each other. It's a wedlock which is constantly riddled with quarrel. The best solution would be to separate out the two. Matter will remain here, spirit will remain here, and that's the end of the matter. You'll be happy alone, and matter will have no quarrel with you then. It will not create any kind of karma. It will remain where it is. Now to say that this matter and spirit will join together and live harmoniously with each other, and supramental manifestation will take place in matter, you are perverse. What is this? Impossible. How can it be? There are two principles, matter and spirit. So that is another group of religionists. You are gone with them. The third group of religionists who say, similar to Jainism, there are only two principles, Purusha and Prakriti. There are only two principles, nothing else, only Purusha and Prakriti. And Purusha is in this body. There is a constant quarrel going on there. How they have come together, we know the machinery. Purusha looked at Prakriti. It fell into trap. Now it is bound in it. And the only thing that has to be done is to come out of it. And I know how to come out of it. I give you the medicine. You do it, you will come out of it. Wedlock has taken place. It is quarrelsome. I can tell you how to get a divorce. And you will be permanently afterwards, you will never get into the trap because you experience this trouble. Once you have gone through it and once you are divorced, you will never come together afterwards, forever and ever and ever. Therefore, to say that you will manifest in this matter is out of the question. Is presumptuous or you are perverse. Or you can say, this world is a sport of God. Sport of God. No, Vaishnavism, Tantricism, this is a sport. This world is a leela. This world is a leela. Of course, there is a big trouble in this leela. It's only sport of God. Take everything as a sport. If you feel troubled, I have medicine for you. You just give up the physical life, all these troublesome things which are happening, withdraw from it, and go at the feet of the Lord, and forever and ever and ever you will remain there. No problem. This was also leela, that is also leela. Better than this to happen here on this earth is perverse. As far as this world is concerned, it's a leela. Why are you worried about? Why do you say it is not satisfactory? It's a leela of God. If you don't find it to be satisfactory, you can come out of it. It's also leela. And that also will depend upon His will. As long as He wants you to remain here, you will remain here. You go to God, say that I am troubled. He may keep you here 200 births in the same body, same kind of body. Or repeated births, after 200 years or 200 births, you will come out of it. To say that this world, in this world, a better leela can happen, I don't see any possibility of that. Because once you go to God, then you can't come back here. It is only there, you remain there. How can you come back to this matter, this world of difficulties? So, if you say that the manifestation of harmony and rasila here on the earth can happen, I don't say absolutely not. But you don't need to. Once you go to Vaikuntha, why should you come here and have rasila? It's not impossible. God can create lila here also. But why? There is no inevitability about it. But you say it is inevitable. Such inevitability is not a part of the leela. This is the argument. Or, there is a story of Mayavada. This world is nothing but a dream and an illusion. To believe that this illusion, when it is switched off, which you can switch off, once you switch off, there will be no illusion at all. This is one illusion has come about. How and why? You don't ask me the question. It is there. But once you come out of it, how can there be such illusion at all? Once you are actually awakened, then you can't fall back into this illusion. And there is no movement. The silent self remains alone. There is nothing else in the world. Therefore, again to say that this world will be manifesting supermind is perverse or presumptuous. So these are...
I want to ask, in Mayavada, the pain is illusion. And in Vaishnavism, the pain is also a part of the leela.
Leela.
Because then to expect a freedom from pain is not God's will, in a way.
In a sense, yes. Some leela that they believe. But the next thing, what is wrong about it?
That's exactly that you have to accept the suffering.
It is His will. Narsingh Mehta was put into prison by Nawab of Junagadh because he was making miracles according to many people's reports. So Nawab called him and said, I hear that you make a lot of miracles. So he said, I don't know. If God is making some miracles, He must be, but I don't, how can I do miracles? It's not in my hands. No. People say that you are making miracles. Make a miracle before me, he says. He said, I can never make miracles. I have never made any miracle. So that means that you are deceiving people. And even that is greater offense now. That you are deceiving people. People believe that you are making miracles. You are misleading them. So you should remain in the jail. So he was put into the jail. Then his daughter came to meet the saint and said, I cannot see you living like this in a jail. And I know that you can always do miracles. It's a fact. I have seen so many things in your life. So he said, but how can I never do any miracle? He said, for my sake, you just pray to Sri Krishna to do some miracle. So he said, all right, if you want that I should pray to Sri Krishna, I will pray to him to make some miracle. I don't know what miracle. So for the sake of his daughter, it was also Leela, he prayed to Sri Krishna and said, my daughter wants a miracle to happen, so kindly do it. And according to the legend or true story, a garland which was in the idol, around the neck of the idol, it flew in the sky and came and settled itself on the neck of Narasimha Mehta. And thousands of people were present here, and the miracle was seen by the Nawab, who fell at the feet of Narasimha Mehta, and the quarrel was over. After the whole event was over, some disciples came and said, how did you feel yourself in the prison? So he said, jo je mara dhani ne gaimu che, e mane kem na game. What was liked by my master, why should I not like it? I was very happy. This is Leela. God allowed that drama to happen, that Leela. And he liked it. If he did not like it, how could he allow it? He is omnipotent. Yes. So this is what happened to him. So this is Leelavada. If God likes it, why should I say I don't like it? When he wants that I should be free from it, I'll be free from it. There's no problem. Nothing will happen without his liking.
It's so poor Vishnu and Leelas. I mean, the Leela. If you could put it in our context, would there be another way of looking at it?
Yes, you can say, God does not like this. God wants you to ask for something more. Then what will you do? And this is Sri Aurobindo's argument.
It's like Sri Aurobindo was bitten by the ants and he said it was Krishna playing with me.
Yes.
And afterwards he says that now it is time for you to go to Pondicherry.
Yes. Quite right. Quite right.
The moment with the ants arrived, he said this is Krishna.
Yes, that's a sentence which statement that he said that that pain was pleasure of Krishna.
So it was
Leela.
He was living in
that Leela. Yeah, but when you want to change, the argument Sri Aurobindo gives is that God does not like the world to remain what it is. The other people say God has made it. It remained, but what is the problem? Sri Aurobindo's answer is, yes, Leela is correct, but he doesn't like this Leela to stop here.
In the first place, he did ask you, why this Lord, when he was put in the jail?
Yes, he said, why this? So, this argument is still to be dealt with. It's not as if it is over, only we have no right to contend with the religionists. Religionists will condemn my proposition. I have proved that he has no right to condemn me. That much I have gained ground in the first chapter. I continue, if you like. The second chapter, is centered on the argument of the rationalist. Who maintains that supraphysical is a hallucination. Therefore, any proposition that is made in regard to the manifestation of supraphysical in the physical is an impossibility. Such a thing cannot happen. Reality is only matter. Supraphysical is not real, so how can it happen? This is why it is called denial of the materialists. And what is Sri Aurobindo's argument? The first argument of Sri Aurobindo is that materialist argument is a circular argument. This is in logical terms. What is a circular argument? A circular argument is that a statement is made in order to propose a proof of it. But instead of giving a proof, you restate it. Then this is not an argument, it's only a circular statement. What is the circularity? Matter is the only reality. This is the materialist proposition. Matter is the only reality. How do you prove it? Because matter is the only thing that we can see. Why is it that only matter can be seen? Because all seeing is done by material organs. Why are material organs the only instruments of knowledge? Because matter is the only reality. Mm-hmm. This is circularity. Second argument against materialism is that this argument is arbitrary. Now, what is an arbitrary statement or argument which is arbitrary? A statement which is made without examining other alternatives and without disproving others. If I make a statement and remain stuck to that statement, then it can be said it is arbitrary. This is the definition of arbitrary. I make a statement, and that statement I make without considering all other possibilities of other statements. I could have made many statements. Instead, I make only one statement, then you can say you have made an arbitrary statement. If I maintain, this is the only statement which is possible to make. You take up one proposition, without examining other possibilities, you just say this is the only possible statement. Now let us see how materialism is arbitrary. It says,
material sense organs are the only means of knowledge. Now, you can see the statement is arbitrary. This is all that materialism says. Material sense organs are the only means of knowledge. If it was to say, material sense organs are means of knowledge, fine. It's a fact. Material sense organs are means of knowledge. In order to show that material senses are the only means of knowledge, we have to disprove that there are no other means of knowledge, no other claims of means of knowledge are available. Have I disproved other means of knowledge? Therefore, this statement, the premise, Sri Aurobindo says, the premise of materialism is that material sense organs are the only means of knowledge. And even if you speak of reason, reason can never go beyond the formula of the material sense organs, reports of the material sense organs. And that's the end of the argument. You have not shown that there are claims that there are other means of knowledge. I have examined those means of knowledge. I have found them to be wrong. Therefore, this proposition is valid. You have not done it. So, Sri Aurobindo says that this statement is arbitrary. And then, what is Sri Aurobindo's refutation of it? As soon as you begin to inquire other means of knowledge, there are suprasensible senses. What about those senses of knowledge? Even the physical things exist without being seen. What about that statement? You can even contradict your physical senses by use of reason. My senses tell me that sun moves around the sky. My reason tells me that the earth moves around the sun. The contrary of it. It's a rational statement. When I examine by reason, I find that my senses are quite wrong. So, senses are not the only means of knowledge. I can apply reason and come to a conclusion, a definite conclusion, it is wrong. So, there are other means of knowledge. Physical senses are not the only means of knowledge. According to Sri Aurobindo, third argument of Sri Aurobindo against materialism is that materialism is a vulgar argument and does not deserve to be promoted to philosophical reasoning. What is a vulgar argument? A vulgar argument is an argument of a man who is uninstructed. It's a rustic argument. A villager who has no exposure to knowledge suddenly comes on the platform of a railway and finds an engine rushing onto the platform and sees piston moving up and down, and he sees steam coming out of it all the time and says, you see, steam is coming out of because of movement of Mr. Piston. Therefore, piston is the cause of the steam. It's a vulgar statement because he does not know that piston itself is moving because of the steam power. If there was no steam power prior to the movement of piston, piston would not have moved. But for coming to that conclusion, he has to go into depth. Therefore, it is a vulgar argument. Or let us say how it is vulgar. I see that matter exists. I see that matter exists. And what is your argument? Matter alone exists.
Your statement is only, matter exists, I see matter existing. Fine, no problem. But you say, no, it's an argument. It's a statement, it's alright. Matter exists, and when you say matter alone exists, it's an argument. So to transfer a statement into an argument is vulgarity. Because you are uninstructed, you cannot turn a statement into an argument. That you are seeing matter, therefore how do you conclude matter alone exists? Simply because you see matter. Even if you say, I don't see anything else than matter, even then, if any claim comes and says, no, there are something other than matter, you should sit up and say, let me examine. But merely because I see matter and nothing but matter, therefore I say matter alone exists, is a vulgar argument. Like many Europeans who come to India and see that India is nothing but movement of cows on the streets. I see everywhere. Therefore, India is nothing but this. It's a vulgar argument. He has seen this, it is true what he has seen, but how can India is nothing but this? It is a vulgar argument, rustic argument. So Sri Aurobindo says, materialism is a circular argument. It's an arbitrary argument, or arbitrary statement only, not argument, arbitrary statement. Or it's a rustic argument, vulgar argument. These are three words Sri Aurobindo used against materialism. So Sri Aurobindo says that when you inquire into supraphysical realities, if you employ supraphysical means of knowledge and you apply criteria of validity, strict criteria of validity, you find that supraphysical realities are sustainable. Therefore, to say that matter alone exists is not a true statement, is not a rational statement, not an acceptable statement. Now, the only thing that remains to be shown is supraphysical means of knowledge exist, and there are supraphysical facts which are verifiable. Now, how do you do that? You can fully refute materialism only if you can state facts of supraphysical reality, means by which supraphysical realities can be seen, and if there are evidences for it. So Sri Aurobindo says that there are evidences. There are plenty of evidences. And even now, new research which is being done, which goes under the name of telepathy and telekinesis and so on, even these rudimentary facts show that there are supraphysical means of communication. You can look at this pair of glasses. She wants to have them right now. She sends a will here and she begins to move by itself. And the pair of glasses reaches there. It's called telekinesis. The capacity to move physical objects by thought, by power of thought. It is said that Marco Polo, in one of his diaries of his travels in India, he has given an eyewitness fact of his own perception that so many people were invited, and one of the yogis who was also invited was asked by the host, please show us something. So he says, I saw with my own eyes a cup which was lying on that side and drawn here, and it came right up to this person simply because he asked for it. There are a number of facts of this kind which are recorded, but if you really want to make a science, you can make a science of it. Such a science exists. So, according to this science, Sri Aurobindo gives the evidence of one most important datum. There are many, many such facts, but Sri Aurobindo gives a description of one important datum in which it can be shown that matter and spirit exist together. Not as separate, but exist together. This is the fact of cosmic consciousness. Therefore, Sri Aurobindo now gives a fact. It's not an argument, it's a fact. Fact as evidence, and therefore an argument. Now, I would like to repeat that statement of cosmic consciousness because it is very important argument also. Page 21. The possibility of a cosmic consciousness in humanity is coming slowly to be admitted in modern psychology, like the possibility of more elastic instruments of knowledge, although still classified, even when its value and power are admitted as a hallucination. In the psychology of the East, it has always been recognized as a reality and the aim of our subjective progress. The essence of the passage over to this goal is the exceeding of the limits imposed on us by the ego sense, and at least a partaking, at most an identification with the self-knowledge which broods secret in all life and in all that seems to us inanimate. Now Sri Aurobindo gives an accurate description of cosmic consciousness, one of the most important data in the building of the total argument of the life divine. What is that? Entering into that consciousness, we may continue to dwell like it upon universal existence. Then we become aware, for all our terms of consciousness and even our sensational experience begin to change, of matter as one existence, and of bodies as its formations, in which the one existence separates itself physically in the single body from itself, in all others, and again by physical means establishes communication between these multitudinous points of its being. Mind we experience similarly, and life also, as the same existence, one in its multiplicity, separating and reuniting itself in each domain by means appropriate to that movement. And if we choose,
we can proceed further, and after passing through many linking stages, become aware of a supermind whose universal operation is the key to all lesser activities. Nor do we become merely conscious of this cosmic existence, but likewise conscious in it, receiving it in sensation, but also entering into it in awareness. In it we live, as we did before in the ego sense, active, more and more in context, even unified more and more with other minds, other lives, other bodies, than the organism we call ourselves, producing effects not only on our own moral and mental being, and on the subjective being of others, but even on the physical world and its events by means nearer to the divine than those possible to our egoistic capacity. Now, this is a fact. This is not an argument. This is a fact. It's a data. All arguments based should be based upon data. Now, the only question is whether these data are valid or not. And Sri Aurobindo say, next sentence, real then to the man who has had contact with it or lives in it, this cosmic consciousness, which are greater than the physical reality. Real in itself, real in its effects and works. And as it is thus real to the world, which is its own total expression, so is the world that real to it, but not as an independent existence. For in that higher and less hampered experience, we perceive that consciousness and being are not different from each other, but all being is a supreme consciousness, all consciousness is self-existence, eternal in itself, real in its works, and neither a dream nor an evolution. The world is real precisely because it exists only in consciousness, for it is a conscious energy, one with being, that creates it. It is the existence of material form in its own right, apart from the self-illumined energy which assumes the form. That will be a contradiction of the truth of things, a phantasmagoria, a nightmare, an impossible falsehood. These two paragraphs are extremely important in the argument of the life theory. Not only is that consciousness a datum, Sri Aurobindo says that this datum can be justifiably regarded as valid. Valid, first of all, to the consciousness which experiences it, and valid also by effects it can produce on the physical world. Not only that, but it is not one singular experience of one person. So you can say it's a hallucination of one man. It is an experience which is shared, as Sri Aurobindo says, in Eastern psychology, cosmic consciousness is regarded as a fact. Unless many people have that experience, it can't be regarded in a science as a fact. In any case, even today, there are people who can have cosmic consciousness. And therefore, by comparing the two or three or four persons having the same consciousness, you can verify it. Of course, it can be argued that a man who has come from a village on a platform, he doesn't have cosmic consciousness. Therefore, it can't be valid. In a science, it can be said that there are many experiences which you can have only if you become qualified. Merely because I cannot share my perception of time as a fourth dimension of matter, I cannot be told that therefore my statement is not true. I can show first of all physical effects of the time being fourth dimension. And secondly, anybody who is prepared to study physics of the fourth dimension and mathematics of fourth dimension, he will also come to the same conclusion. Therefore, merely because it is not shared by all people in the world in a vulgar manner, I don't need to say that a thing in order to be believed in must be shared by all people, whether you like it or not. The validity of our experiences, first of all, it must be real to myself, first of all. Even to real to myself means, when can I say that I am not dreaming? I am seeing this now. When can I say I am not dreaming? If I can remove from my present state of consciousness all the conditions in which I know I can dream, I remove all those conditions. I rub my eyes 3-4 times. I make sure that I am not got up from sleep. I beat myself with a physical cane and I feel pain physically. I do all myself to prove. And I know that I don't want to deceive myself. Really. I know the distinction between deceiving myself or making a statement just to make a statement to somebody else. I know it. I can make a false statement to somebody. Oh, I see Sri Krishna here. I know that statement I can make. But I also know that when I am now seeing Sri Krishna, I am not making that kind of statement. I am not trying to affect you or to prove to you. I am really seeing Sri Krishna here. The boy in the guard, he was seeing Sri Krishna when his teacher did not see Sri Krishna. He saw it. And he was not sleeping, he was not in dream, he was on the battlefield before everybody, all the people are around. He has brought all of them to show Sri Krishna. So he's not dreaming, all others are present. So, I am myself quite sure that I am not dreaming, I am not deluding anybody, I know myself what is called my objective experience, and I apply all the standards myself to say it is really objective. That is first. Secondly, I can also say that there are 3-4 people at least in the world, if not my alone person, who also have the similar experience with the same condition. What is the probability of my statement? Now Sri Aurobindo says the cosmic consciousness is a consciousness, a fact of that kind.
So Yoga's Vibhuti Pada also is also...
You are right. Yeah, it's given there. You are right. Yes, all these are proved. In India, that's why Sri Aurobindo says, in India we have no problem.
Patanjali has already affirmed it.
Affirmed why? Because not because he is only his own experience. Not only he has said that if you follow the path of Sanyama, anybody who passes through Sanyama
is qualified for it.
He is qualified for it. He has shown it.
And he has shown it.
Therefore, Yoga Shastra, why is it called a Shastra? It's a real science.
Yes.
No, moreover, you know, one peculiar thing is there in Patanjali. He says that if you don't believe me, and there is no need to believe my statement, you go ahead with the experiment and then come to me.
Quite right.
Unless and until you experience it yourself. Okay. And he has given many options, you know, and he says that, okay, you don't have to go with various options. You can just go with one, experience it yourself, affirm yourself, and then go ahead. Then there will be no doubt.
Quite right. So in a way, Sri Aurobindo says that his cosmic consciousness is a fact.
Yes.
Now, having stated this fact, he says we have reconciled in that experience universal matter and universal supermind.
Sure.
Both seem to be existing, and I can see both. I have reconciled matter and spirits in one single experience. Therefore, the argument that matter and spirit are basically fundamentally different from each other is disproved in this experience.
And moreover, sir, this life divine consists of every system of philosophy. Sankhya, Vedanta, Vaisheshika, everything, everything is there. You know, when you read it and you, if you have little knowledge of all these systems of philosophy, you can really summarize it and understand it beautifully.
Very true. Alright, but this is not enough. Now Sri Aurobindo goes forward and he says there are yogis who have a cosmic consciousness. But they are reporting not only one or two. It is even stated in the Upanishad. That there is an experience which is not cosmic, which is transcendent. And in that transcendent experience, cosmic consciousness ceases. Now, this experience is described in the Upanishad, and Sri Aurobindo describes it here. At the gates of the transcendent, he says, there stands, page number 22, last paragraph.
Or at the gates of the transcendent.
For at the gates of the transcendent, see the accuracy of it. It is not in the transcendent. At the gates, because even beyond this experience is a further experience, which is keeping a room for it.
Mm-hmm.
For at the gates of the transcendent stands that mere and perfect spirit described in the Upanishads, luminous, pure, sustaining the world but inactive in it, without sinews of energy, without flaw of duality, without scar of division, unique, identical, free from all appearance of relation and of multiplicity, the pure self of the Advaitins, the inactive Brahman, the transcendent silence. Now, this is also data. It is on account of this particular phenomenon, this experience, that a problem arises. Sri Aurobindo says that there are individuals in whose case they have passed suddenly from mind and landed into this gate of the transcendent. It has happened.
Sri Aurobindo says, in his own case it has happened. His guide told him, throw away all the thoughts that come to you. And suddenly he passed, within 3 days, into an experience of this kind, where that inactive reality is found to be absolutely silent. In cosmic consciousness, there is multiplicity, all movement. But here, in this, there is a complete silence, complete inactivity. And in that state, if you look at the multiplicity, you find it doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. Sri Aurobindo himself has given the, I read out that quotation from Sri Aurobindo. This also is an experience. It is also an experience which can be verified. It is true to the one who has experienced it. And it is a state of tremendous awakening, so there is no question of dreaming. Supreme awareness. And such an experience is not only one solitary example. That experience was repeated by Sri Aurobindo himself in 20th century. So it's not only one experience somewhere which was described in the Upanishads for the first time. Even there it was not for the first time it described. That experience has been described so often in history of India and other elsewhere also. Now here you have to evaluate two experiences which seem to collide with each other. That is real or this is real? Cosmic consciousness is real or this transcendental experience is real? According to some, this transcendental experience is the real experience. And that experience is sublated. This word sublated is very important. What is sublation? An experience is said to be sublated when it no more remains in the presence of another experience. When I wake up from my dream, then I can say dream is sublated. That is why it is said that when you enter into this transcendental consciousness, cosmic consciousness is like a dream. It is sublated. Now Sri Aurobindo confirmed that such an experience is a fact. So Sri Aurobindo asks a question. Page number 26. What then of that silent self? You got it?
Yes.
What then of that silent self? Inactive, pure, self-existence, self-enjoying, which presented itself to us as the abiding justification of the ascetic. What about that experience? Now Sri Aurobindo answers. Here also harmony and not irreconcilable opposition must be the illuminative truth. The silent and the active Brahman are not different, opposite, and irreconcilable entities, one denying, the other affirming a cosmic illusion. They are one Brahman in two aspects,
positive and negative, and each is necessary to the other. It is out of this silence that the world which creates the worlds forever proceeds. For the world expresses that which is self-hidden in the silence. Again, this is an argument, this is a statement of datum of experience, that you can have an experience where the silent self and the active self are both seen together, reconciled together. It is out of silence the world proceeds. The world itself proceeds from the silence. So it is not as if two things are side by side. It's not juxtaposition. That very self is active, which is inactive, is itself active. Our understanding that active and inactivity are opposed to each other is an analogy from our own experience. But when you go through that experience, you find that that inactivity is itself active. That's why Sri Aurobindo said, this is a fact of experience. It's also datum. And therefore, and this datum is also permanently available, in which both the experiences, even that sublated, also comes back. The transcendental also comes back. So, and that remains forever abiding. And this experience is not only the experience of which Sri Aurobindo speaks here. It is the experience which is described in the Upanishad itself, in that very place where Sri Aurobindo describes that one, in that very sentence. If you bring that sentence, I like to read it so that it becomes very authentic. Ishopanishad? No. The book is here, no? Ishopanishad? I'll read out to the, that very sentence in the Upanishad itself. That sentence itself speaks of both the statements.
What do you say?
No, not that one. That is another, but I am only that we have described. What is important is that that statement which Sri Aurobindo described at the gates of the transcendent, that very sentence is followed by next sentence. And I want to read out the second sentence where active self is described. It is not as if two sentences, it's a one sentence in which the first sentence describes the first part. The second sentence, no, that is afterwards. That is after that. You see here, I'll read out to you that sentence. The full sentence is this. Paryagat, sa means he, active. Paryagat means has gone forward. Who has gone forward? He that is Shukram, not Shukraha. Shukraha is the one, is a he who is pure. Shukram is that which is pure, it is inactive. He is active, and this Shukram, it could have described like this, Saparyagata Shukraha. But no, Upanishad is very careful. It says, Saparyagata Shukram, Akayam, that is also neuter, without body, Akayam, Avranam, without scar of division, Asnaviram, without sinews, Shuddham, pure. Apapaviddham, it is without any kind of blemish. Kavihi, Manishi. Now it is, masculine comes up. The very sentence itself gives you both the description of the inactive and the active. And this is the authority. I mean, it's not only Sri Aurobindo's experience. Of course, Sri Aurobindo also has the same experience. But that description of Sri Aurobindo of 20th century is also to be found in a book which was written long, long ago. And exactly in these terms, it speaks of inactive Shukram, Shuddham, Asnaviram, Avranam, Akayam. All this is absolutely inactive. But Saparyagat, it is he who has gone forward. And then says, Kavihi. Not Kavim, it's not a neuter gender. Kavihi, Manishi, Paribhuhu. Now this is a purely active. Paribhuhu. Bhuhu is that which has become. Pari means all that has become. It is that which is inactive. It is it that has become all. Paribhuhu. Swayambhuhu. His self-existence out of himself. Yatha tathyataha arthan vedad. As conceived by him, he has arranged all the things as conceived by him. Shashvati bhyaha samabhyaha. From eternity, it is not only it is eternal movement. And all the things as he had conceived are being manifested. These two propositions put together show the two are not contradictory. If they are contradictory, one would cancel the other. If that stands, akayam, then how can you say paribhuhu? Therefore, the two words are not contradictory of each other. It's a very important question. Can you club two contradictory terms together? Inactive is active. Is it a self-contradiction? Logically, it's a very important question. Is inactive active? Whether something is self-contradictory or not is to be judged not merely by the words which are used, but whether the words describe exactly the fact as it exists. What is important is not the words used. What is important is the fact. Now, if as a matter of fact the inactive is active, as a matter of fact, if inactive is active, if the word itself proceeds from silence, can you say silence is purely silence? Word proceeds from silence, such is the nature of it. That's why Sri Aurobindo says that logicians dismiss active inactive together merely because the two words which are contradictory of each other are put together. Therefore, Sri Aurobindo says opposition is verbal, but not real. This is a distinction. It is true that two words are obliged to be used. I mean, why Upanishad, these rishis, why were they obliged to write the same sentence? It's one sentence alone. It's not two sentences separately. Description Saparyagat. It is he who has gone forward. Who? That which is Shuddham. That which is absolutely silent. That which is silent has gone forward.
The logicians are not able to see the oneness in the contradiction because they apply it only to material things where this is actually not possible.
So that's why I'm saying that therefore Sri Aurobindo says that when you apply, you should be careful. You are describing a reality which is of this nature. If I say the white light consists of seven colors, He says, self-contradictory. How do I know? Word-wise, it is self-contradictory. One white light consists of seven colors. One white light consists of seven colors. It's self-contradictory. And I'll say, it's wrong. Can't be true. Therefore, whether the words which I am using are really self-contradictory or not will depend upon what? Not merely by words. In words, I have got to use it. I cannot avoid it. As Shrivindu says, we have not a language which can describe this kind of reality at all. You have to find a way of expressing. At least in Sanskrit language, it was possible. The same sentence using saha and tad. In the same sentence, at least Sanskrit language is one in which you can use both he and it for the same reality. Therefore, you can make this statement. But in English language, it's not possible. He and it can't be put together in the English language. Such is not allowed in the language. So what can you do about it? So merely because your language does not allow it, will it not be a fact? It is true that anything that contradicts the law of contradiction must be rejected as false. Granted. The question is it really self-contradictory? If I say white light consists of seven colors, is it really self-contradictory? And this I cannot judge merely because of the words which I use. I have got to go back to the reality and see for myself. This is the important argument. Sri Aurobindo says that higher than the, at the gates of the transcendent, this experience stands. But when I go to the transcendent itself, I see both together. Not only together, but word itself proceeds from the silence. It is such a reality, like the seven colors proceeding from one light, one ray of light. It is proceeding. What can you say about it? It's such a reality. So Sri Aurobindo says we must judge reality by what it is. And we must go back to it. Therefore, the datum is so important in the argument. Don't go merely by words. If it's a very argument, the statement, and this statement is not only in the Upanishads, not only here. Even the Bhagavad Gita says, I am at one kshara and akshara, I am Purushottama. So even Gita's experience is also to be taken into account. And this experience is also in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, in the Manduka Upanishad, Paratpara is not only para, is Paratpara. Kathopanishad also says beyond all this is Purushaha. Beyond unmanifest, it says, Avyaktat Paraha Sa Purushaha. And beyond that Purusha, there is nothing more. It's also Kathopanishad. Unmanifest is silence. Beyond silence is He, Purusha. Saha, it is not Tat anymore. It is Saha Purusha, it is He, the Purusha. So, Kathopanishad says, Manduka Upanishad says, Bhagavad Gita says, even this Ishopanishad says, these are all records of experiences. They are claims to be the experiences. They are not merely statements made by this Rishi, I am only copying it here. These are statements of experiences. Sri Aurobindo in the 20th century also verifies and says, I also have the same experience. And that if you follow my path, I will show you that that path will also lead you to the same experience. So, now, let us see. This statement is very important. The silent and the active Brahman are not different. Opposite and irreconcilable entities. The one denying the other, the one denying the other affirming a cosmic illusion. they are one Brahman in two aspects, positive and negative. This is true also of the electric current. Even the same current, they're positive and negative, and it works all the time. Even a battery requires two cells, one positive, one negative. Then only it works, otherwise it doesn't work. Why is it so? The same current, positive and negative, and each is necessary to the other. It is out of this silence that the world which creates the worlds forever proceeds. For the world expresses that which is self-hidden in the silence. It is an eternal passivity which makes possible the perfect freedom and omnipotence of an eternal divine activity in innumerable cosmic systems. For the becomings of that activity derive their energies and their illimitable potency of variation and harmony from the impartial support of the immutable being, its consent to this infinite fecundity of its own dynamic nature. It's also a fact. This is not an argument. This is a fact. But a fact which is extremely important to the totality of the argument. If this is so, then you can say that in the cosmic consciousness you have reconciled matter and spirit. In the transcendental consciousness you have reconciled the silence and activity, both. And therefore now you find reality omnipresent. This is called the omnipresence of the same reality. This reality, which is active and inactive, is to be found everywhere. This is the reality. Now you start with this statement based upon facts. Undeniable facts. If the facts are only floating facts, then you cannot give reliance to it. But these are verifiable facts. If so, now the conclusion follows from it. A very important question. Page number 13. Huh? If we thus accept a positive basis for our harmony. You got it?
Yeah.
And Sri Aurobindo says, and on what other can harmony be founded? This is a philosophical question. There is none other possible. Having shown these facts to be the facts, we start with the strength. And even then he says, can we find anything else? On what else can you found your starting point? Then, if this is so, then the various conceptual formulations of the unknowable, this transcendental, Sri Aurobindo uses the word as unknowable. Paratpara, the one who is Purushottama, is unknowable because this is a word which we should define to ourselves. Sri Aurobindo uses the word unknowable because first of all, it is wonderful. Wonder can never be known. It can be admired. Wonder cannot be known. Wonder cannot be known. If it is knowable, it is not more any wonder. When I say I'm wonderstruck, when can you say I'm wonderstruck? When you can't explain. When you don't understand. Yet adbhutam, this is the word. It is wonderful. So it is not that unknowable, in, not in the sense that it cannot be known, not cannot be experienced. You can see the wonder of seven rays coming out of one ray. It's unknowable. How does it happen? That you cannot explain. Not that it's not knowable. You can put prism, the red, the white light, and you can see seven rays coming out of it. But it's unknowable. In that sense, Sri Aurobindo uses the word unknowable. No, it is not knowable. Not that you can't experience it.
Experience
the
degree of what you can experience.
Yeah, that is to say, no, you experience it.
That's what I'm saying. You can experience it, but you try to do it.
Yes, you cannot. And even if you do it, it is still wonderful. It is really unknowable. It's not only that you have no words to express. It is truly unknowable.
And when you experience it, it is unknowable.
That's right. I mean, I see the sky in the early morning, how wonder. Even a rainbow I see, how wonderful it is. You can't make out, why should I see these seven strips of light in one, all of them combined together, and there is no gap. I mean, the wonder of wonder is, there is no gap between the two. It's not seven all separately standing out. How does it happen? In that sense, it's unknowable. So Sri Aurobindo says, that active which is inactive, that inactive which is active, is wonderful reality. It's not self-contradictory. It's a real unknowable. So Sri Aurobindo says, the various conceptual formulations of the unknowable, each of them representing a truth beyond conception, must be understood as far as possible in their relation to each other and in their effect upon life, not separately, not exclusively, not so affirmed as to destroy or unduly diminish all other affirmations. We must not make this destructive effort. If it is yellow, it can't be blue. Why? Because it's blue. How can it be, yellow? If I make such a statement, I'm destroying. I'm not allowed because reality is not that. How can I be allowed to destroy? Now Sri Aurobindo comes with the real position of life divine. The real monism. The true Advaita. Is that which admits all things as the one Brahman. Ultimate reality is one. And does not seek to bisect its existence into two incompatible entities. An eternal truth, an eternal falsehood. There is no such thing at all. This is the direct, when Shankaracharya says reality is one, his position is called Advaita. But he himself says, this world is an illusion. He himself says, so it is not dual, it is not non-dualism. Although that is an illusion, you have got to refer to it. As long as you have to refer to it, it is there. And you ultimately say, I don't even refer to it. And yet you have to say, I used to refer to it. And now I don't refer, but I used to refer to it. Even that statement, if you make, is already dualism. It's not a real monism. The real monism, the true Advaita, is that which admits all things as the one Brahman and does not seek to bisect its existence into two incompatible entities, an eternal truth and eternal falsehood. Brahman and not Brahman. Self and not self, a real self and unreal yet perpetual Maya. If it be true that self alone exists, it must be also true that all is a self. And if this self, God or Brahman, is no helpless state, no bounded power, no limited personality, but the self-conscient all, there must be some good and inherent reason in it for the manifestation, to discover which you must proceed on the hypothesis of some potency, some wisdom, some truth of being in all that is manifested. I dwell upon this argument. Reality is one. Cosmic consciousness, transcendental consciousness, and supreme transcendental consciousness. If you put together these facts, you find there is only one reality. Therefore, all that is there must be contained in that reality. This is the logical argument. Not only that you see all things there, but is there only one reality, all must be logically included in it. Now Sri Aurobindo says, one step further, a hypothesis, an argument. If this self is a further elaboration of the same argument, if this self, you may call it also by the name of God or Brahman, by whatever name you give, if this self, God or Brahman, is no helpless state. It could be, you can argue and say, it's a helpless state. What can I do? Something happens in me which I have no control over. There is only one reality, I am the only reality, but something in me happens over which I have no control at all. It can happen. But Sri Aurobindo says, if you maintain that that self is God, is Brahman, and if it is not helpless state, because if it is helpless state, you have to explain. Helpless because of what? You can be helpless only if somebody else exists who makes you helpless.
Or somebody else exists who makes you, who can help you.
He can help you, yes. So, if there is only one reality, it can't be helpless state. So, if it is not a helpless state, no bounded power, there is nothing else. So all the power it must have must be all powerful. No limited personality because can't be limited. Then what is it? But if it is a self, all, self-conscient all, if all is contained in it, there must be some good and inherent reason in it for the manifestation. To discover which we must proceed on the hypothesis of some potency, some wisdom, some truth of being in all that is manifested. Now this argument is one of the most fundamental arguments of the Life Divine. These three sentences. That is to say, if matter exists in the way in which it exists, and seems to be so contrary to the ultimate reality, then instead of saying, oh, it can't be, don't jump. You must weigh. If there is something which is disconcerting, you must find out why. What is the point? How this disconcerting thing has happened? Instead of saying, can't be. If this is the reality and yet suffering exists in the world, don't say therefore that reality doesn't exist, only suffering exists. Or the suffering doesn't exist. Don't say that. Neither. You must make an effort to discover why it has happened, why it should happen, what is the point in it. It only invites you to inquire. And this inquiry is the whole book. If it has happened, if there is something disconcerting, you must find out why and how it has happened. There must be some good and inherent reason in it for the manifestation, to discover which we must proceed on the hypothesis of some potency, some wisdom, some truth of being in all that is manifested. The discord and apparent evil of the world must in their sphere be admitted, but not accepted as our conquerors. The deepest instinct of humanity seeks always and seeks wisely wisdom as the last word of the universal manifestation, not an eternal mockery and illusion, a secret and finally triumphant good, not an all-creative and invincible evil, an ultimate victory and fulfillment, not the disappointed recoil of the soul from its great adventure. This is what we have to work out. This is the ultimate of the four chapters. When we say reality is omnipresent, this is the ultimate sentence we arrive at. If there is an evil, it's not to be denied. As some people say, it doesn't exist. Or to say, it can't be explained. Or that, somehow it is there, what can we do? God is such a lilavad, He is capable only of creating this suffering world. So He has created this suffering world. Even that answer can't be satisfying. That God was capable only of a world in which there was suffering, and therefore this world has come about. Was God capable only of a suffering world? He couldn't create a better world. Even you and I can create a better world. Was God not capable of creating a better world? And yet if it has happened, we must be patient. We must inquire. This is the invitation of the life tree, of the whole book. There must be some reason behind it. There must be explanation of it. The reason why this particular question is asked so squarely, as in no other metaphysical book. In every other metaphysical book, this is the question. There is one answer which is given. Oh, the world is what it is. God exists. Wonderful, beautiful, omnipotent, omniscient, omnipower. But this world, He created out of nothing. Nothing. He couldn't have created out of Himself because He is so good. How could He create out of Himself this kind of world? This is one answer. You may not be satisfied. People say, I am giving an answer which is not satisfactory. But this is what God Himself has told me. Now what can I tell you more? That this world I have not created. Out of nothing I have created this world. So believe in it. This is one answer we have yet. Second answer is, all this God is bunkum. There is no God at all. Just see the world as it is. Full of suffering, pain, and no justification at all. Some children are being hounded by dogs. Ultimately, children are overtaken by the hounds and they are torn apart and killed. What sin have they committed? Children, innocent children. Why should these hounds be after the children? If God was there, He should have said, look, these children are innocent. Hounds should have been restrained by God. He should not have allowed them to be hounded. They are innocent children. What kind of God is there are you talking of? Therefore, all talk of God is bunkum. World is what it is. And you can do best, you can do whatever out of it. You talk of justice, injustice, all these are notions which you create for your internal adjustments. The world doesn't care for it. If children, innocent children can be hounded and can be eaten away, what is justice in this world? It doesn't exist. World is what it is. Be realistic, be practical. World is what it is. You are suffering, you can reduce suffering. You can take this drug, you can take a wine, you can have all kinds of wideness you can do. What more can you do in this world? Or I get an answer, this is delirium. This world is a delirium. It's a dream. Doesn't really happen. Can't be happening. You can see that in none of these answers, there is a real answer. It's a Buddhism rejected God. He said, this world being what it is, how can you speak of a God? God can't exist. Can't be there. Jainism also says the same thing. If God exists, this kind of world will not be. He could have created a better world. God is not there. You are only to accept the fact that world is what it is. Jada and Chetan, these two are there. Somehow they have come together and I can only give the medicine of divorce. These are the only answers available in the world today with regard to the world. But if reality is omnipresent, as Sri Aurobindo says, these are shown to be facts of experience, then, which cannot be denied, they are there unreliably, then the world must have some wisdom in it, some explanation in it. And that explanation we shall have to now look for. So we stop here today, huh? In fact, this is a summary of all that you have done for the last 6 days.